Hi, I'm Hal Plotkin. Thank you so much for joining us today to this panel discussion and multiplier event of the De-Reskill at Universities project, coordinated by Foundation Maison Sciences de l'Homme and led by four collaborating universities in Europe: the University of Milan, the Open University of Catalonia, Sorbonne University, and Budapest University of Science and Technology. We're very happy today to have with us Richard Culotta, the CEO of the International Society for Technology and Education, who's played a leading role here in the United States and globally in helping to develop policies and implementations of advanced uses of technology in education. And our colleague Andrea Innamorato, the executive director of Open Education Global, which is a large membership organization of colleges and universities that are involved in sharing intellectual property to promote education and economic development and enhanced opportunity. We hope also to be joined today by Philippe Moutot, the European director of the Industry Engagement Unit at Thales. But you know, these international conversations are prone to technological considerations that are sometimes beyond our control. And I'm sure Mr. Moutot will join us if he's available. So let me again thank the sponsors of this conversation and move quickly into the heart of it. We've got a lot of topics related to advanced technologies, including artificial intelligence and lifelong learning to cover. And let me begin by reintroducing our guests, or rather allowing them to introduce themselves. And I've asked them to begin the conversation today by considering the question of the intersection between advanced technologies, including artificial intelligence and lifelong learning, and to describe what they think is the single most important consideration for senior level decision makers as they try to modernize national systems of education to create more economic opportunities for upward economic mobility and career development opportunities for people seeking support, modernized support that technology can provide in education. Andrea, if it's acceptable, perhaps we can begin with you and you can introduce yourself to those viewing this today, and perhaps describe a bit of your perspective on these questions.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Hall. And well, good morning and good afternoon, everyone. Can you hear me well? Yes. Okay, great.
Yes.
I'm Andrea Innamorato. I'm Spanish Brazilian. I'm speaking to you today from Seville in the south of Spain. I am a doctor in educational technology and a researcher in educational technology for about 20 years now. And I'd like to thank Hall for this invitation to be part of this leadership school and have the opportunity to speak to you about these important topics. Very briefly, I have worked for the European Commission for 9 years. I left last year exactly on the digital skills agenda. And now I have the pleasure to be the executive director of Open Education Global, an organization that is primarily in the US, but we also actually globally trying and make the connection between different stakeholders and promote the understanding of what open education practices are and how institutions can work together to make education more democratic and available to all. So apart from that, I'm also a researcher. I hold a research seat at the University of Barcelona, which was an award I've received from the Ministry of Science and Technology in Spain. So when it comes to the question that Hall has asked us, now what would be the most important challenge and opportunities for policymakers in higher education governance? Well, this is a very vast question, let's say. We could be talking about many things, but in this intersection of technology and policy, you know, when we see research and policy, I would really like to focus on the role of micro-credentials, right? So, because when we talk about micro-credentials, we are really talking about a number of different technologies. Now we're talking about technologies for the recognition of formal and informal learning. We could be talking about blockchain-based micro-credentials. We could be talking about, for example, the European Blockchain Service Infrastructure, EBSI, and the governance of all of these infrastructures, no? So I would suggest that apart from artificial intelligence and everything, I think micro-credentials are one of the most important and challenging things that for policymakers and higher education institutions nowadays, because they are key, in my opinion, to help the upskilling and reskilling of the workforce in general, no? And the citizens as well, in terms of their general digital competence to be able to act in the social world we live in nowadays. So as we know, last year, the European Commission published a communication called, what is the name of the communication? A new role, it's the European Strategy for Universities. That was the communication in which there was a call for universities, a really strong call for universities to act in their third mission, which is actually this intersection between scientific knowledge produced within the university to with the social, no, with the society and everybody out there, industries, citizens, so on and so forth. So universities are really placed in the center of this very important transition that we call nowadays not only a twin transition, but also a triple transition, which is digital, green, and social, because there are many social changes going on. No? So when you think of universities in the center of this transition, of this triple transition, and we think of micro-credentials, I would suggest thinking of two things. In the non-formal learning sector, we could perhaps see as opportunities to be considering more open education practices, which go way beyond open educational resources and MOOCs as we know them, but it really involves more open recognition practices, open learning, and reuse of a number of contents and resources produced in many parts of the world in order to educate better our citizens and even policymakers and governments all over the world about the social challenges that we live at. We don't need to be duplicating efforts. We can reuse, you can tap into existing efforts. And I think open education really promotes the possibility of collaborative practices. So, and then we can link non-formal education, non-formal learning practices with the formal sector. And I'm finishing here with this idea of what I consider also an opportunity for universities, but also challenging would be to consider how to create this international infrastructure, nor how to help orchestrate this international infrastructure for the not only the issuing, but also the validation and recognition of micro-credentials. No? To me, that's a big challenge, but also if we manage to put this together somehow, working together between universities, we would be linking non-formal learning with formal learning, and we would be really advancing practices in terms of upskilling and reskilling, particularly on topics related to the triple transition. Well, I'll stop here, Hall, but I'm open to going further later on. Thank you.
We'll discuss that more in detail in just a few moments. Andrea Inamorato is the Executive Director of Open Education Global. Let's turn to our colleague, Richard Culotta. Richard, you helped lead the open education resources efforts in the Obama administration, and now you are leading an industry group that's deeply involved in many of the same issues. I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about yourself, your background in these issues, your organization, and your perspective on this question. Some people have told me that this issue of I was just talking with a senior level in the education ministry of a European country not long ago, who said that as they're grappling with these decisions, Richard, that it sometimes seems like in the current climate that they're piloting a sinking ship in a hurricane. And others have told me that they think this is the greatest time of opportunity in terms of the opportunities that technology creates to achieve a real advance for humankind in creating educational and career development opportunities. This has been your work. I know you have a new book out on the topic as well. Perhaps you could tell us a little bit about yourself and your perspective on these issues.
Sure, happy to, thank you. It's a great pleasure to be here with you all. As you see, as you know, I'm Richard Collada, and as Hal mentioned, I run the International Society for Technology and Education, ISTE. We work in about 80 countries around the world, providing support, particularly at the elementary and secondary level, helping to provide effective learning experiences for young people. But our work is very clearly tied to the goal of helping them thrive in future learning and future work. So we care a lot about what the workplace of the future looks like and spends a lot of time there. I had the great privilege, not that many years ago, of actually working just down the hall from Dr. Plotkin when we were at the U.S. Department of Ed. Both of us were appointed by the Obama administration, by President Obama, and we're leading this work. So it's always great to be able to have a chance to reconnect with him. And I will say, Andrea, I loved your going with micro credentials. I completely agree with the importance of looking at micro credentials as we shape the future. Let me share two things. One is just a little bit. I'll mention that I just recently wrote a book, and so I'll share just what that is. It's a book called Digital for Good. It's published by Harvard, and the book is saying, hey, I think we're getting our approach to preparing young people for this digital world that we're living in a little wrong. And the approach that we're generally taking is going in and saying, here's the list of don'ts. Here's all the things not to do. Don't cheat, don't share information you're not supposed to, don't be a jerk, don't let your data get out the way it's not supposed to, don't, you know, it's this list of don'ts. When I look at what we're seeing and the trends in the world, our future society, our future democracy is rapidly moving to exist in a digital world. Many of our lives' most important moments now happen in virtual, not physical spaces. And becoming a healthy member, a thriving member of that world, is a highly complex skill. And any highly complex skill, whether it's learning algebra or whether it's learning a language or a sport, any highly complex skill requires practice. And you can't practice not doing something, right? If you're learning to play the piano, you can't say, here's all the notes not to play. And you can't memorize all the notes not to play and then be able to actually learn to play well. At some point, you have to practice that skill. And all of our setup, all of how we set globally, how we have set up preparing young people for this digital world is all about negative. It's all about the don'ts. And we're not having opportunities for them to practice the do's. And that's going to be a real problem. And so my book lays out five ways that we can shift that conversation and help prepare young people for this future. The one other thing I'll share as a point of background that might be useful is our organization, ISTE, has something that we call SkillRise. I'm just going to share the screen real quick. So SkillRise is an initiative where we lay out the digital competencies of the future workforce. And we believe we have this thing called the profile of the lifelong learner. And it talks about what are the skills, you can see we have a lot of people that are part of this, but what are the skills that are required to be able to qualify for these jobs of the future? And you can see them here, being a lifelong learner, knowing how to continually learn, being an empowered worker, a solution seeker, a mindful colleague, and a digital citizen. Back to what I was talking about the focus of my book, which is on that one. And so what I hope this does, and this is all available for free, what I hope this does is help provide some common language around the types of skills that we need for the future. Because it's hard enough getting these skills for people, but it's even harder when we don't have a common language to be able to talk about them, because then we're reinventing all of the, you know, all of our wheels and all of our approaches everywhere. Last thing that I'll share, and then I know we want to open it up, but since Andrea talked about micro-credentials, as we think about the future and the real transformation that we're going to see coming, I can't not talk for a minute about generative AI. And obviously that was going to come up. We knew it would, but I want to talk about it because I really do think it is such a critical element of what the future is going to look like for a number of reasons, and they're probably not the reasons that most people think about. I am not so worried about it just replacing jobs that people have. I'm sure some jobs will be replaced. I saw some data from the World Economic Forum that said, you know, AI will replace 70 million jobs. And then the next line, that's the one they always quote, everybody quotes, is going to replace 70 million. The next line of the report said, and it will create 130 million new jobs. So I'm not worried about, the job loss thing. I'm worried that the new jobs that will be created will be jobs that people won't be qualified to take because they don't understand how to work with AI. And so the story that I'll share to illustrate this is in our organization, we were approached not long ago by General Motors, main big car corporation in many parts of the world. And they said, we have a problem because all of the cars that we're gonna be building in the future are basically drivable computers. And all of the people that are gonna be designing them are gonna be building them with in an AI infused environment. And we are not preparing people now to be able to take those jobs because we're not talking about and we're not exploring what it means to work in an AI infused environment. All of the people graduating from our, certainly our secondary schools, definitely our post-secondary programs in the next few years are going to be working on teams where not all members of their team are human. And I don't know that we're preparing them for that. We also need to be very careful that we're very quick to say, oh, we ought to be careful about AI because there's bias in the data and we can't trust the decisions. And that's true. But one of the things that I want to call out is we need to be better at asking the question, when is it inappropriate to hand an important decision off to AI because of the bias? And when would it be irresponsible not to hand off an important decision to AI because of the bias, right? We also have tons of bias. And so it's interesting to look at AI and go, oh, there's bias there, and pretend that we are somehow not biased in our decision-making. And so that's an important skill that we need to be learning is, when is it appropriate to hand an important decision off to AI? When would it be inappropriate to not hand a decision off to AI based on where we can get a more valuable decision? So lots more thoughts on that. I'm going to pause there, though, because I want to keep going with the conversation, but really excited about, you mentioned how before you handed this over, some people think it's a ship sinking in a tornado, others look at it in the future. I definitely fall on the glasses half full side. I'm very optimistic about the future, but it will require some really specific changes in the way we approach education and workforce training if we're going to take advantage of these opportunities.
That's a wonderful beginning to our conversation. Thank you very much, Richard and Andrea. Andrea, as you know, it was interesting that Richard put up the illustration of the skills identification work that his organization has been doing. As you probably know, one of the goals of the D-Reskill project is to incorporate the ESCO classifications, the European developed classification of skills and competencies, into the design of a new app that hopefully will be developed in a subsequent phase of this project that would help Europeans identify the skills that they have, the skills that they would like to have, and the new occupations they could transfer into. This, coupled with the comments that Richard just made about AI and about the role that digital competencies play in just learning how to learn and then learning how to work in the new environment, pose enormous challenges, both for commercial for-profit businesses and for the open education community. How can the community that you're so deeply a part of as a leader respond to these challenges with regard to the most advanced digital technologies, including artificial intelligence, and make good use of these skills warehouses or skills libraries like the ESCO database and also the similar resource that Richard was discussing.
Thank you. Thank you for this comment. And indeed, I fully agree. And with both of you and with your comment also on how, because the situation is that I think we need to keep on working in terms of awareness raising about open education, because it's a movement that has been going on for many years now, nearly 20 years, let's say, and we are still very much attached to the licensing, you know, so to try and understand, because it's such a vast concept. To talk about open education, what is it? Each one of us would have something coming into our mind. And it's important indeed to start thinking of these new technologies, you know, and what else is out there already available to us, and that is already openly licensed because it's an open software or open data or open content somehow that we can use and tap into to help us in terms of upskilling and reskilling. So I think you're absolutely right. And one of the goals of our organization now, well, continues to be, and I think it's an ongoing goal, is to increase this awareness raising in terms of what open education practices are. And this includes connecting universities, connecting minds, connecting policymakers to understand that it goes way beyond, you know, the production of free and open online courses, which are absolutely essential in my view to help towards the upskilling and reskilling, but also to look into, you know, this vast opportunity of artificial intelligence and data that is open out there for us to use and collectively produce research that can help us advance different fields, no, as a whole. We know that the role of open science, for example, during the COVID pandemics was absolutely essential, because by publishing in the open, no, we managed to advance research for vaccines, etc. So I think in my perception, we really need to take into account what we are talking about, the role of technologies, but also open source technologies and open source data. No, so we are talking about here the role of openness in general. And in that sense, it's really amplifying when we think about the stakeholders, because we work very much sometimes with university managers, no, the deans, the faculty directors, the rectors, but really innovation can take place bottom up and top down. No, so we should also perhaps be thinking about on more professional development for lecturers, teachers, and career paths that are more open. But for this to happen, some educational systems really need to change and be more open. And obviously, I find ESCO a fantastic way of categorizing, no, the jobs that we have. But I also find super important what Richard was talking about, which is the future skills. No, this is skills mapping that we call future skills or skills for the future, in the sense that are we really looking at them? But then we have the task of being really reskilling and upskilling the entire population, and not only the ones that are going to the university right now. Now, what about the ones that are already there working and that are going to try and keep themselves in the labor market? No? What about the elderly people? How can they really follow up so that we don't increase the gap and then gender gap and other things? So this is really a big issue for me. So future skills for me are very much related again, and I'll go back to this link between non-formal and formal learning, because we can do a lot of this preparation of the workforce and citizens through non-formal learning via MOOCs, etc. And then if we want really to push forward towards more, let's say, professional education, then we can move and make the link to formal education via open learning. It could be one of the possible routes to that. So yes, I think I touched upon a little bit on what you're talking about, but absolutely essential to think of AI and to think of these classifications. Yes.
Thank you. And Andrea Innamorato is the Executive Director of Open Education Global. Richard, let me come back to you for a moment. First of all, I find much to agree with in your comments, as always. There's only one thing I would disagree with, just to correct you on, which is to let you know that I am not Dr. Plotkin. I appreciate the award of an honorary doctorate, but out of respect for those who've actually achieved that milestone in life, I should let you know that I'm Mr. Plotkin, and to you, of course, as always, Hal. But I'm very interested in your observations now that you've spent so much time in recent years leading this industry group about the role of business in accelerating progress in this area. Obviously, there's this tension between resources that are freely shared and freely available, and the need for businesses to generate income and profits so that they can sustain their participation in the education marketplace. With specific reference to how high-level policymakers can work most efficiently in order to create the greatest number of opportunities for people, one of the goals of this specific project, where your advice would be very valuable, is the development of a wireframe design for an app that would connect Europeans and presumably other users around the world with a better understanding of their own talents and capacities, and then direct them to a catalog of training opportunities or education opportunities, some of which may be offered by industry or other groups, where they could benefit from participating. When you think about that kind of an app, first of all, you're one of the people that I could ask with more confidence than most, does it already exist? If it doesn't exist, what would be your ideal design characteristics? What's the fantasy app that you would love to see the European community invest in developing that would accelerate the kind of progress that you were describing earlier? Or is it already out there?
Wow, great. There's a lot in there. I'm excited about this. First of all, let me say on the opening comment that you made, I am a strong proponent of open licensing, and you know that, and how you and I have worked on this for a long time. I also believe that there's a really important role for the private sector, for commercial industry to participate, which means that I'm hated by both sides. but I do think that the future is going to look like a mix of the two, and in some really important ways. And I think both have an important role to play. Now, the question about, is there a skills app, right, that helps us recognize the skills that we have, and then based on that, what skills we may need, and what opportunities there may be based on the skills that we have. That is absolutely the goal that we should all be looking for. We finally have a technology infrastructure worldwide, largely thanks to COVID, by the way. I know COVID has caused a lot of trauma and real serious challenges in the global economy and in our workplace, but it has also brought with it some infrastructure improvements that allow us to do things like this type of app that you're talking about, Hal, that I think are really critical. So I think we need to do this. Micro-credentials are critical to this. You can't do this if you don't have micro-credentials. I think they're inseparable. You have to be able to have a granular, competency-based way to articulate your skills before you can then see where the gaps are and what opportunities are available to you. A transcript from an institution that shows what courses you sat in will do nothing to help you figure out those skills. There are some really exciting movements underway to try to shift transcripts from being about seat time, which they essentially are now, to being an articulation of skills accomplished. And you're going to start to see some pretty impressive shifts. And the way that this is going to happen is not blowing up the traditional transcript. That's going to, that'll take a long time to do. What you're going to start to see is institutions doing dual transcripts. So a transcript that's the traditional one that says, here's the courses that I sat in, that I breathed successfully through the semester. I didn't die during the course of the semester. There it is. I've showed it there. And then a dual transcript issued alongside of it that articulates the skills that were learned. And that's what we're going to start to see over this coming over this next year. And I'm really excited about that. Now, does this exist already? No. Are there apps or are there services that are starting to work towards it? Yes, there are some, and there's some that we can learn from in exciting ways. There is a project called Opportunity at Work, for example, that is trying to work in the tech sector particularly and say, here are some assessments of your skills, your current skills, and based on that, here are job opportunities, and here are additional skills that you can add in order to be able to qualify for additional job opportunities. There is an interesting program in South Bend, Indiana, of all places in the United States, where a community, a town, got together as a community and said, "Can we consolidate, or at least catalog, all of the learning experiences that are available in our community, and then based on that, have some sort of interface that identifies what your skills are and what opportunities there are for learning." So there are these pieces that are out there. There are people that are working on this work. We are nowhere near just having the app that you can download. And we absolutely should be working on this. But the thing to be really clear about is we have to be careful about not oversimplifying the interests of the people that are participating and the granularity of the skills. So in some attempts in the past, you sort of come in, you're like, what are you interested in? Are you interested in finance or education or, you know, whatever, healthcare, right? These like huge categories that are so huge. And so, no, we have to do a much better job of saying to the individual coming into said app, what are your passions? And it's not by answering a silly three-question multiple choice test. We have to do a much better job of really understanding where are their areas of interest. And then based on that, be able to look very carefully at what opportunities are available and where they have had these, you know, sort of micro-credentials that show what their skills are and help tee up what the possibilities are. The easiest way to just summarize this is to say, if it starts to feel black box, we have failed. If it starts to feel like you answered these three multiple choice questions and now we will tell you that you should be a physical therapist, right? That is not helpful. What we need are tools that are actually helping guide the exploration process of people to figure out what they are interested in and what adjacent skills they can add to their skill collection. And by doing that, what that will allow them to qualify for. That's very different than the black box of enter your information here and we will spit out what job you should go apply for. And so we just have to be careful that we don't oversimplify that process.
Very interesting. Andre, I wonder if you have any reaction to that question, specifically with reference to the goal of the European community here in developing an app that would use the ESCO categorizations. Our colleague Francois Rocher just pointed out in the chat that the ESCO taxonomy of skills and competencies is updated every 3 years. So there's a very active effort at a very deep level of engagement in Europe to create and provide and share these categorizations of skills. Is there a role that the open education community can play in conceptualizing new, more advanced apps that would be applications that would be available in Europe and around the world to help individuals navigate these opportunities? And what advice would you give to the design of those applications? And how might the open education community work with the commercial technology sector to balance the interests of both groups and also achieve progress that would be collaborative?
Thank you. Wow, there are lots of comments and questions into this. Yes, I don't know. I was thinking of commenting on what Richard said, and then you also talk, talked about this app that the European Commission wants to create, and then talking about the interests of sectors. So let me see if I can at least touch upon some of these, right? Because it's quite a lot, and I'll try and be brief and touch upon some of these. So in terms of creating an app, I think it's good. It's always helpful. You know, so if we have a common language, as Richard was saying, to talk about things, we have to be able to make this common language to reach citizens somehow. So you have to help them. Nearly everyone has a mobile phone nowadays, particularly in Europe, in North America. No, we're talking about mostly Europe and in North America here today. So I think everything that we can do in terms of technology that has the goal of reaching the final user with a very user-friendly type of application, this is fantastic, right? So I just wanted to mention that this morning I was participating in a closed workshop run by the European Commission Joint Research Center, where I used to work, on the creation of what they call an European Digital Skill Certificate. Right. You may be aware that there is a whole feasibility study on what it would look like. And so all these conversations about what should it be, how should it be, how will people accept it? I think it's all part of when we create apps that are related to classifications, or when we create certifications, we are always dealing with ever evolving things. No, so apps involve jobs evolve, qualifications need to be recognized by government bodies and also by employers. So we are really diving deep into a new way of conceiving society, of understanding our relationships, right? So what I wanted to get at here is that I think there is a role for everyone. You know, I really think not only of as Richard was saying, an app for people to be able to understand their skills, but being very careful not to put them into boxes, but also a wallet, as we are trying to create in the European Union, where people can actually decide what to show to prospective employers or not, where they have their micro-credentials there, you know, and they have really control over their data. So all these things are super important. And now in terms of the open education, or what is open and free and the public good, let's say, and the private, there is ever more convergency. Because I must say, I am here in this organization, Open Education Global, but I don't see it in the extreme of saying that we have to be 100% open on everything, because it's not always possible. No, some people believe if something is not 100% open, it's not open enough, or it's not open education. I think we have to be very careful, because when we sit on this extreme, then we are being closed rather than open. So I think there could be a lot of collaboration between sectors in terms of technologies that are developed by for-profit organizations, and what out of these technologies could be helpful to the open education community, to universities and open source. And I can see already an effort in Europe to bring together different stakeholders, you know, so everyone now needs to collaborate. So governments, associations, NGOs, corporations, and citizens, because we don't always talk about people per se. No, we talk about cohorts of organizations, and we don't talk about individuals, and they're very important, right? So I do see convergence. I don't see necessarily any sort of clashing in terms of interest. I just think that everyone can find their niche. And this, in my view, is happening. You know, we're having more of that openness possibilities nowadays.
Excellent. Richard, we have a question for you from one of our colleagues, Francesco Bellini. Francesco is a private sector entrepreneur in Europe who's part of our consortium, and who has the responsibility for helping to guide the development of the blueprint for the application design that's one of the anticipated products of this collaboration, this consortium. And Francesco is asking if you can talk a little bit more about SkillRise. Perhaps you could put it back up on the screen. He wants to know, does it provide the list of the skills that are part of these larger skills that were quickly flashed in front of us? Is it a website? Is it in? Are there APIs to access it? Are there opportunities for Europeans like the universities that are involved in this project to collaborate with ISTE in the further development and increased utility of skill rise?
Yeah, great questions. Thank you for asking. Let me, I will actually share the screen again while I talk about it a little bit. So so our goal, and we'll be very clear about what our the goal is, we are trying to provide, so for years, ISTE has provided the global standard for competencies around the elementary and secondary education skills that are needed when it comes to using technology effectively for learning. Those are called the ISTE standards, and they're available for free. They're used all around the world, and they provide common language that then people can align curriculum to in order to prepare young people. What happened is we have gotten an overwhelming series of requests for a similar approach in the workforce space for adult learners, and generally for adult learners who may, you know, not have gone through a formal college experience, or may have been in a workforce for a while and have missed some of the digital skills that might have been picked up in other ways. And so this was a group of foundations came together and funded us to create this set of competencies. So you can see the high level competencies here. Yes, under each, there are a series of sort of more granularly articulated competencies. There's a great, and I don't know if this will work as I'm screen sharing here. Let me try this and see if it'll work. Yeah, so this is the slightly more in-depth version of it, and you'll see under each of the categories, it gives three practices. So lifelong learners set and achieve individualized learning goals related to work and life. That's one of the goals that we want to be able to see under the lifelong learning category, et cetera. And you'll see that through all of those categories. Again, available to use, download for free. Our goal is to help people be able to leverage these as common language. There is more research and some assessments that we are getting ready to release. So learners or organizations that are working with workforce that want to use some of the assessments to help be able to tease out where a group of people are will be available soon. And if you're interested in that, certainly please reach out. There's contact information right on the SkillRise site. Just reach out to the team and they can send you more information. And of course, soon it will be up on the website itself.
Excellent. That's really very helpful. And I'm so fascinated. I'll come back to this in a minute. You're raising the topic of progress and assessments. I'd plan to get to that, and I'd like to get to that before we conclude. There's a lot of work going on in that. But quickly, we have a question for you, Andrea, which you started to answer in the chat. And Richard, you're welcome to chime in on this in just a moment. But we hear so much talk in terms of advanced technologies, not only about AI, which we've talked about a bit, but also blockchain the role that blockchain may play in open badges. Sometimes it seems like sort of a lot of vapor, a lot of smoke without any real substance, but others continue to insist that blockchain will be an essential part of more advanced approaches at the institution and national level toward identifying skills and training opportunities. Andrea, do you have any thoughts about where blockchain fits in on all of this, or is it really too soon to make any predictions about that?
Perhaps it's going to be a very biased response from my side, because I was the editor of the first report on blockchain in education that we published in 2017 at the European Commission. And then we were already studying what universities were doing in terms of blockchain and their degrees, their diplomas, etc. No, so I am a big fan of blockchain. I see it also as part of the future, as much as AI, you know, not only as part of the future, but as present. There is, as you know, there is the Europass in the European Union that has been revised, and then there is the EBSI, the European Blockchain Service Infrastructure, and it would be very nice to see how those things will converge in the future through the universities' alliances. It's all about governance, in my view, and it's also some sort of standards, because we would need to know how to classify, how what would we need to know from an open badge, for example? What sort of metadata should an open badge carry to, let's say, replace, you know, our old paper and Excel database in universities, and that are then registered on a blockchain and interoperable and shared by the final user through a wallet? So there is a lot to think about there in terms of in terms of methodologies, in terms of standardization, interoperability, governance, who should be part of these blockchains, public as open public infrastructures, and how really to recognize them in the labor market. So universities tend to be very conservative when it comes to recognizing diplomas from other countries, other universities. So it's more than time to reflect upon how we can be talking about these advanced technologies if we're still sometimes very much attached to traditional practices that we find difficult to modify and let go within our own systems and institutions. No, and why do I say so? I say so because we had a move to the online during the pandemics, but at least here in Spain, most universities have come back to the full face-to-face type of model because they say students prefer like that. We don't have the policies in place to have a curriculum, being carried out online. So we need to change our infrastructure. And so there are many layers that, in my view, need to act more quickly from ministries to quality control agencies, to universities, teachers, so that we can get to the final user with this dream, let's say, or fantastic upcoming apps and tools that we are talking about, based or not on blockchain, that are related to ESCO or related to these European digital skill certificates, whatever it is that we are talking about, because there are many, many converging projects going on. So yes, I do believe in blockchain, and I think we should be looking more into how to connect all those things together.
Richard Culotta is, Andrea Innamorato is the Executive Director of Open Education Global. Richard Culotta is the CEO of the International Society for Technology and Education. Richard, it's been about a decade since we've been hearing about blockchain and its impact on education. So far, this may be a bit cynical, but so far it's been used mostly, it seems to me, to separate investors from their money. But I don't see it a lot in our daily lives the education sector as education policymakers. What are you seeing from your perspective, working so closely with industry? Is there substance there? Is there ways that we should be thinking about incorporating it, or is it perhaps a bit overblown?
Look, so I would say there are important needs for validation of information in education in ways that cannot be easily miscreated or modified, right, without the appropriate signer. We know that that's needed, and it's really critical. It's critical for micro-credentials, it's critical for a whole variety of things. It's critical to be able to have the learners own their own learning data. So one of my biggest frustrations is the vast majority of your learning data and your career and your experience, you don't own. It's owned by some institution that you might have to pay money in order to get a copy of, but it's your data, it's your information. And one of the things that we are starting to see in some other industries, healthcare in particular, is that starting to shift. It's starting to shift. And so now there are tools and apps and systems so that we can own our healthcare data and then use it how we want to. And the reason that that's working is because there has been infrastructure that can validate that the data hasn't been tampered with. And that matters, right? It's a trust verification that whoever said you had this skill, or in the case of medicine, that you had, you know, this diagnosis, was the person that this data says it was, right? So I believe very strongly in that. Now, does it need to be blockchain? Is it possible that solution is a highly over-engineered solution for the type of verification that we need that really isn't that complex? Perhaps. And perhaps that's why we're not seeing it. I think it's why there's a lot of excitement about it, because we know that we need good verification. We need good validation in order to have this credential world work. But do we need something so complex as a blockchain in order to do that? Probably a little bit overkill. So I think that's where I would land on that.
And that leads naturally into what I think will be the final major topic for our conversation today. So grateful to you both for your expertise and sharing your time with us today. Richard, you talked about validation in education. And of course, one of the principal ways that we do that, Andrea, is through tests, through assessments. You know, in the conventional world in which those of us with grayer hair grew up, we took examinations, final exams, things like that. And that was how the instructors and the institutions determined whether or not we'd mastered the content we were studying. We're moving into this entirely new world of lifelong learning mediated by advanced technologies. And I think, as both of you know, I've been spending some time in recent years working on a project developing advanced assessments, simulated assessments for college credit through a consortium of universities. What role do you see for assessments connecting people with opportunities instead of just judging whether they've achieved the mastery of a subject? And what would the next generation of assessments look like if they were designed in the ways that would accomplish the goals that you have for education and opportunity? Let me start with Andrea on that question. What do you think about the next generation of assessments for lifelong learning and how they might be used in the most constructive way?
Thank you. Thank you all for this comment. I would like to say that the theme of assessment, you know, well, there is the one who takes the assessment, but also the assessors. And also, who are these people behind creating the assessment? So who are these people and which are these technologies? So those two things need to converge also into the systems, right? And I just want to share with you that we have recently ran some studies based on an European framework called G-Compedu and OpenEDU. So based on these two frameworks for digital competence for educators and open education for higher education institutions, we tapping into these frameworks, we've created a questionnaire online, which is called the checking tool for higher education. It's available for free. Some questions you answer, and in the end, you have a report that indicates your level of competence in certain areas, right? It's for teachers, basically, mostly for higher education teachers or lecturers, no? And one of the areas in which they scored, they had the lower scores was actually assessment. And that's very worrying. So I would like to, not here to dream about what sort of technology we need, but I would like to go back to the root and say, what sorts of continuous professional development opportunities we are creating for lecturers, for teachers, are we creating in universities to make sure that we're able to make this leap into better technologies and technologies that are really able, or assessment ways that are really able to connect knowledge to actual societal needs in the labor market and people to employers, so on and so forth. So I really would like to answer this, not really focusing on the technology, but focusing again on a human-centered approach, perhaps more of a digital humanities where we have to have the universities and the teachers, you know, and the ones who control that idea of the assessor and the assessment, no? And how we are actually looking into providing opportunities for continuous professional development in terms of new ways of assessing for lecturers, right? And so I would leave it there, but just to say that this study we ran in Ibero-America with more than 34,000 lecturers responded, 7 Ibero-American countries. It's published in the format of a research paper we've published recently. So assessment was one of the skills that they scored, they had less score, fewer points scored in the same at national level study we carried out in Spain with more than 5,000 lecturers from 51 universities in Spain, and we had the same situation. And the worst actually also worse than the assessment skills, we had skills on open education. You know, we realized that lecturers are not aware of what open educational practices are, or they do not really understand how to bring them and use them in the context of their institution and in their roles. So because we also had an open education assessment part in this questionnaire based on the Open Edu framework. So yes, so I really think that we need to start more looking at the root of this whole thing rather than focusing on the technology. So this is my two cents on this.
Thank you, Andrea. Richard, in just a few minutes that we have left, I wonder if you could share your hopes and dreams with us about, and your advice to policymakers and decision makers about next generation assessments for lifelong learning and career advancement. Where are we, and where can we go with that?
Yep. Happy to. And let me start with a real quick and forgive what is a sort of a shameless plug. But I had mentioned earlier in the conversation a book that I recently published called Digital for Good. And I just want to highlight it here quickly because it goes in depth into a very short answer that I'm going to try to give here. But if you want to understand this more deeply, please check this out. And what I say in the book, a real key part of the book, is that when we look at how we've used technology in the learning space, we have used it in largely ways that we've struggled to use it in ways that have encouraged curiosity. And no place is that more obvious than when it comes to assessing learning. And it's funny because you think about if encouraging curiosity and assessing learning, it sounds like these are two separate things. I actually don't think they should be. And one of the points that I make in the book is if you look at video games, games that students, you know, kids love, young people love, teenagers love to play. They're going through, they're highly engaging. You have to pry it out of their hands. At the core, those are assessments. Those are learning assessments. You're going through, they even have points. They even assign points, right? You go through and there's a task that you have to do, and you are then rated by points on how well you've done. And then you will either be able to move on to the next or be able to go back. Video games, digital gaming, are learning assessments. And so why is it that video games are so compelling, they drive curiosity, and are so of so much interest and value to young learners? Why is that the case? And going and taking an assessment in any, you know, college course, any university course, is not. When at the fundamental level, they are the same thing. And so I think what it means is we need to spend some time looking at how we are designing the future of assessments. And again, we have some technologies that can be really helpful to do this. There are some things about video games assessments that are important to know. One, you almost always get another shot. So we don't go in and we say, you have one chance to do this level and that's it. You've this game that you paid $50 for, now gone, you can never use it. No, you say, try it again. In fact, try it as many times as you want, right? In order to help gain mastery, that's one. A second is there is exploration that is allowed. You can actually learn through different paths and trying different paths. That's also really exciting. There are a whole bunch of other ways, and I won't in the 30 seconds I have left, I won't go through all of them now, but I think we need to be looking at how can we leverage digital tools that make very engaging, very compelling experiences to rethink and redesign assessment? And the last part that I'll say about this is that when we use, throughout this conversation, I keep talking about the importance of language and how we use words and how we talk about words. We often use assessment as this big, we just lump everything under assessment, but there are some different types of assessments that are very different. There are summative assessments, which of course we have at the end to say, you know, do you get your final degree? Do you pass? I'm a pilot. There is a final assessment that I have to take before I'm allowed to fly a plane. And that's good. And we want it to be there, and we should do that. But we often forget that there's this other whole category of assessments that we call formative assessments, which I actually think are far more important, and they get far less attention. And those are the assessments that we use along the way to help our learners and us as you know, instructors or faculty members, whatever our role is, to see where those skill gaps are. And those types of assessments always get missed. They're always the last to think about. They're always the least valued, and yet they're the ones that have the greatest potential to think about reinventing and redesigning learning. So I'm excited. I think there's great things that we can do in the assessment world. It is the area where we can where the bar is the lowest, where we can do a lot more innovation. It's also the area where the fruit is hanging the lowest. There is so much that we can do there that we haven't explored. And so I really encourage us to look at the future of learning assessments with technology.
Excellent. Unfortunately, what a wonderfully provocative and useful and informative conversation today. The time just flew by as I knew it would. So grateful to Richard Pulotta, the CEO of the International Society for Technology and Education, and Andrea Inamorato, the Executive Director of Open Education Global. I don't know if we've solved the question about whether we're living through a time where policymakers and education leaders in this field are piloting a sinking ship in a hurricane, or experiencing unprecedented opportunities for the advancement of humanity. But I do know that we're more likely to be in the second category because of leaders like Andrea and Richard, who are so committed to the public good, to advancing opportunity around the world, and to collaboration. And I hope that you will become even deeper collaborators with the D-Reskill at University project as it moves towards sustainability phases. Let me also thank, before we conclude today, our colleagues, Professors Corinne Aubert and Professor Roche at Sorbonne University, and also Alexandra Dupere at Foundation Maison Sciences de l'Homme for their work in coordinating and creating the opportunity for today's dialogue. We look forward to future dialogues and future multiplier events. Please check in with us from time to time, and we'll let you know. We'll have another one next month, and then one the following month. And look forward to continuing these conversations as we build a curriculum for decision makers in Europe and around the world on this question of advanced technologies and lifelong learning. Thank you again, all of you, very much for your participation today.
Thanks a lot.
I wish you good night, good morning, good afternoon, and look forward to seeing you again.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Oh, thanks.
Bye-bye.
All. Bye-bye.